And welcome again to this week's version of The Collector's Show. Thank you for listening. I'm Harold Nickel, the host of The Collector's Show here on Web Talk Radio. We'll get to the news here in just a moment. In the interview segment of the program, Mike Kay, you may remember Mike from the previous iteration of the program where he talked to us about collecting metal lunchboxes. Now, it turns out that Mike is an Emmy-winning set designer and sets for television. And in addition to his lunchbox hobby, he has also developed a comic book that he's going to tell us more about. Mike, a very accomplished artist in his own right, with a story about how this comic book developed that will make you shake your head. It's prophetic how this came about and how it also affected his life more directly. And he'll tell you more about that in the interview segment. And then, of course, our friend Larry Zale joins us. Last week, Larry talked to us about how to look for things, the type of shape they're in, their condition, coloring, exposure to moisture, etc. And this week, and this will apply to collectors across the board, he's going to talk to us about what to look for and how to make sure that you have things in your collection that make a significant contribution. That in our segment with our friend Larry Zale. A quick note from the world of collecting. You know, sometimes you can go looking for one thing and find something else. And that was the case with a family who went diving, scuba diving this summer out in the Gulf of Mexico. They went out into the Gulf looking for shark teeth, specifically, and I hope I say this right, megalodon shark's teeth. They thought they would find them, but instead they found the wreck of a World War II plane that had crashed off of Venice. The plane, a P-47D Thunderbolt, crashed during a training run during the Second World War. The Venice Army Air Base was located at the site of the current Venice Municipal Airport. The people who found it, the Pratt family, have turned the wreckage over to the Venice Museum, to a Mr. James Hagler. So when you embark on a diving expedition looking for shark's teeth to add to your fossil collection, you just don't ever know what you're going to find. You might find a wrecked World War II plane. Interesting stuff. More interesting stuff to come. And still plenty more interesting stuff to come right here on The Collector's Show. My name's Harold Nickel, and this is Web Talk Radio. Well, we've got a returning guest on The Collector's Show today. I always like stories where there's a happy ending, and someone with whom I'm acquainted has the opportunity to use his or her interest in collecting, regardless of what it might be, and they have the chance to invent their own job. So our guest this week has done this, I'm thinking, not once but twice. We're going to be talking with Mike Kay. And Mike was with us a few years back talking about his collection of lunchboxes. And we're going to talk about where he is with that. But lately he's taken his interest in comics to a whole another level of creativity. You'll have the chance to know more about both of those collecting hobbies and how you can order a first edition comic from the man who wrote and illustrated that entire new work here on The Collector's Show. So, Mike Kay, welcome back.
Hi, thank you for having me, Harold.
Let's talk first of all about what we spoke about when you were with us before, your lunchbox collection. Tell us about the lunchbox collecting hobby and how you first got interested in that.
Well, you know, I didn't start collecting lunchboxes. I've been an artist my whole life, but I did start collecting when I was little, and even though it wasn't lunchboxes, I had a lunchbox as a kid, but I collected stickers, Garbage Pail Kids, Rabbit's Feet, and even as a little kid, matchbooks, believe it or not. I never thought to light anything, but I collect them when we went to restaurants, and I would just kind of grab one before we left, you know. And eventually I discovered that my brother had some drawers of comics. And he let me have them because he didn't care too much for them anymore. And I built a very nice collection as the years went by of just comic books, and I still didn't touch on lunchboxes because it wasn't a thought. But one day I brought my comics to a dealer, and he jipped me. He took them for $50, and I was a teen, you know, and you get emotional and you don't think, and you just do it, and I wish I can get that day back. There was no eBay, there's no grading system. But the few pieces of artwork I had from the comics, I took those, and I was able to salvage the money from selling them, and I figured, what should I collect now? And I was in my 20s, and I thought, well, lunchboxes, I remembered as a kid, and you always want to reminisce on the past. So I thought, let me start searching. And even though my first box was a He-Man and a Pac-Man, I ended up buying the first mint box I saw, which was a Fall Guy.
Oh, wow.
And it had a tag with it, and it had the tissue paper on the thermos, and I thought, wow, this is really bringing back the memory of carrying a lunchbox. So, but as of today, it's now become more of a novelty, you know, and the new, they have new replications of them, and they're really just tins with vinyl stuck to them. And I couldn't believe when I saw recently like a Batman vinyl stuck to a tin, and they numbered it to whatever number, and it was going for $500. And I thought, you know, maybe the 1960s Batman I could see being $500 because that was the original one intended for kids. But these new ones, I don't see how people see that as an investment. You know, it's a novelty item.
I actually owned that Batman lunchbox when I was in like the, I think I was in the second or the third grade, and it wasn't just like you were saying an embossed sticker stuck on a metal box. It was embossed, and it had, you know, the metal was stamped. It was dimensional, and it was really a neat piece of art. And somehow, I guess I got sick of Batman or something like that, and I spray painted my Batman lunchbox, and man, that was dumb. But I know what you're saying, that I don't know why anybody would want to pay for what amounts to an inexpensive print when for the same dough they could have probably the original.
Yeah, which, you know, originally was intended to carry lunch and not just to sit on a shelf for novelty.
And they had thermoses inside, and the manufacturer was the thermos company. In addition to having the lunchbox with Batman or Star Trek or Charlie Brown, you had a thermos on the inside. And what little I know about this hobby is that if you had the complete set with an unbroken thermos that had the lid, the cup, all of that together, that was a much more valuable piece.
Collection, you know, it became more of, for me, a turnoff. And so I've now focused more on my mission of, you know, bringing my comic book series to the readers and the collectors, you know, and focusing on that, and where there is a market for it. And, you know, there's much more collectors of a comic than there are lunchboxes in the world.
Let's explore that, because as you mentioned, you're a graphic artist, and speaking as somebody who always wished that they could draw but can't, I really admire that skill. But your original interest in lunchboxes was really based on your work as an artist, and you had an experience that I think is just this by itself would make a great story. But you had a medical experience that kind of triggered your comic book memories. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it was, you know, one day I had visited a dermatologist. It was more so because, you know, out here in Florida, I just got bad skin, you know, always dry skin, and there's lots of allergies and stuff. But he had discovered a type of melanoma that was on my back, and it wasn't something I had thought of. It was just looked like a freckle to me, but he said it has to be removed, and so I went with it, and it was pretty excruciating, the pain. And he called a few days later. He said, you know, the roots ran deeper than he thought. He has to go back in. And I said, what does that mean? And he said, well, I have to take away more of the problem.
So perfect.
I went back there, and I never encountered anything. I never knew anyone with this problem. I never thought this could happen to me, you know. And as he was digging, I felt like I'm a victim on a table, you know, being cut like a steak. And so it's, for weeks I was in pain, and it just sore, and, you know, I was devastated over thinking, you know, how fragile years when my father passed away, my uncles, my grandparents, lots of friends and people in my life that passed away over the years. Actually, about 20 or so, I have to say, since today,
wow.
They died. And so I started to reflect, and I thought, you know, being an artist, where does it really take me? I draw every day. I'm paid as an artist, but I had this book that I created back in 1989 that it's been sitting in the shed, and it was actually about a doctor who's dying of cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, that's ironic because I never even knew anyone at the time that had cancer or even thought about it. But I just thought, you know, make a disease someone dying of and make a story out of it. And so I went back to my shed, and that's where I discovered that drawings were there. I had ruined most of them. They were yellowed and bent, and some of the letters had fallen off because this was pre-computer. This was all hand-drawn, you know, and hand-glued from a typewriter even, the letters. And I thought, let me take it out of the shed and look at it. And I actually had showed my older son the book. He was little at the time, and he said, that looks like a good story. You know, why don't you make something with it? You know, so I thought, well, I started reading it and thought, it's still a good story. Even 20 years later, you know, no one really came up with this kind of idea. You know, you have a doctor who's dying of cancer. He stumbled upon this extraterrestrial gem that falls from the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And when he gets wet, the gem turns him into a frog guy. So as awkward as he is, people now say, hey, you're some kind of superhero. Why don't you help me? Because there's other gems falling, and people are finding those. They're becoming these villains, and they don't know what they're doing either. They're just fusing with them. And so he kind of takes it upon himself to say, well, I'll start finding and destroying these gems, but I would like to remove this gem of my own because now I sit here, you know, wasting my life helping others, really have no insurance, and what am I doing? And so he contemplates taking his own gem off of him because it fused with him, but at that point his cancer would return, so he keeps it on, you know, to battle.
Yeah, so the backstory on this and most superheroes is that they've got something that's happened to them that you could look on it and you could say, oh, it really is a blessing, but you could also say, oh, it really is a curse. And so it sounds like it's close enough, you know, to the usual genre of comic stories that it could be successful. Now, when you say gem, you're saying G-E-M, and mm-hmm. is it like a pendant or a ring or a belt buckle? How does he experience the gem?
Well, you have a different planet. It's called Planet Skyba, and there's a greedy king, King Trell, he goes in the Krinkow Forest up in this planet, and he discovers an ancient crystal transforming machine. So he takes this machine, and he thinks it's like a camera type of thing, and he presses it, and it starts turning each person into a gem. It crystallizes them, but it traps their souls in the gems. And so he opens a photo studio and starts turning people into gems, and he sells the gems at the local village, and they're like, wow, these are beautiful, they're bright, they're colored, but they don't know that souls are trapped in them. And when his plan is destroyed and the gems start coming to Earth, the people here start picking up beautiful-looking gems, and it fuses to their forehead.
Okay.
And nothing happens at that point. It's just that you have a gem stuck to you, and you don't know what to do, and only other heroes that have gems in them can remove your gem. But in the meantime, if you activate the trigger event, which you don't know what the trigger event is, you become something, a mutant. So in Ampho Man's case, he touches water, he becomes Ampho. And there's other characters. There's Bleach, who is a bird warrior. And when the sun comes out, his gem turns him into a bird man. But his Indian tribe, they think he's some evil spirit, so they banish him from being in his tribe. So he's kind of like a vigilante. And then you have the Black Bull, who lives underground. He's kind of like a pervert recluse, but he finds this gem that, with darkness, he can become a bull that can alter the earth. He can open up the earth and swallow people, and he tests other gems on the victims.
I don't think anybody can ever get past the description pervert recluse. Yeah, that's not. You don't want to be known as, oh, he's the pervert recluse. Nobody wants that. So
yeah, well.
So
you always have one, you know, somewhere. They just don't tell you.
Right. So the characters have evolved, and the thing that intrigued me about the story was that you, I think you said you were 13. As a 13-year-old boy, you draw and illustrate and write this comic, and you put it away, and then however many years later, you have cancer, and it reminds you about the fact that you had invented this character. I think that's just really a cool story all by itself.
Well, and you know, the part of being a doctor that's starving, that all trickled from my father originally. He had said, Michael, because he saw the interest I had in art, and he's like, there's plenty of starving artists in the world, but there's no starving doctors. And he was trying to explain to me to just go to business school or be something more than art. And I did go to business school, and I graduated from business, but I wasn't happy. And that same week, I said, I art is where I want to be. And my dad was like, I understand. You don't fit in with the stockbrokers, you know. And
right.
I went back to college, and I got a second degree, this time in art, actually 3D animation.
Oh, wow.
And so I had art and business, but the art is where I said, that's where I feel safe and comfortable, and that's what I do, you know, that's what I know how to do. So over the years, I've won awards, Emmy nomination for a set design I created.
Wow.
And so then I figured, you know, rather than sit with art hiding in a shed, I should take it out. And part of the whole part of me bringing it out is not for the money, because as a 13-year-old, you're not looking to be, you don't even know what you're doing. You're just drawing out of passion.
You sure.
Know, you have a desire. And as the years went by now, I think I want to put it out there, and I say to myself, why would people care? You're up against Marvel. You're up against DC. I mean, these guys, they are taking over every store there is. You don't know of anyone else.
And that was what I wanted to talk to you about also, was the fact that you self-published these, used your own money, and then you had to not only pay for that, but you went out promoting the book by yourself, and you found a couple of places to sell the comic book. Tell us about your experiences with promoting your very own self-published comic book.
Well, it the first day when you take 22 years to finally make something, you're very proud of yourself, and you say, where do I start now? It's kind of like, never thought past this point. So after 22 years, I say, here's my published book. Let me throw out some emails. So I looked in the back of a guide. I threw out probably 200 emails to every comic store I could find, every place. And I got about 40 responses, and I was like, wow, I'm onto something. And when I clicked on them all, they're like, stop spamming me. Stop, get me off your list. Take, and I said, oh, wow.
Oh, dear.
That was the first wall I hit, you know. Then I said, well, let me locally try to drive around. So I drove around, and they're like, oh, this is a great thing. Okay, we'll put it on the shelf. I said, great. How much do I get? And he said, oh, no, just leave them here for free. And I said, well, what if it sells? Well, we keep the money. We're taking off the shelf. So I said, oh, so basically, I'm a charity now. I got to donate all my books.
Well, that's a good deal for them. That's a terrible deal for you.
Yeah. So I mean, I was encouraged for a little bit, and I said, well, here, and I gave some, and they were selling. But then I would come back, and they say, you want to put more? And I said, well, do I get anything from it? Well, no, but at least you're getting your name out there. And so I stopped with that, because there's only so much you can just give away, you know.
Well, yeah. I mean, you have to. I mean, everybody has to get paid.
Yeah, so, you know, eventually I just started different approaches, you know, and when the news heard that one comic store in particular in Lauderhill, Tate's, he took my book and bought it from me, actually paid me, and it took only, you know, a couple decades to get to that point. They thought that was, you know, newsworthy. So from that, I then did a signing, and I signed hundreds of autographs, and then I was invited to a thrift shop here, which I'll be going to in December, and they said, we love it, you know, we would like a local artist, and and all my sales for each of the books I've been giving to cancer research, so I donate a portion to cancer research.
Oh, good for you.
And I feel that the big business, they pump out, you know, hundreds of thousands of books each week, and it's just a business with deadlines, and, you know, in my case, I mean, you take a couple decades to get a product out. You want to make sure everything's perfect to be comparable. But on top of that, I look from a collector standpoint, because I'm, you know, going back to the collector day, I know it is good for a collectible. You know, when it's a comic book, you don't want a novelty. You don't want it over-published, you know, 10 million copies available. And you want a good story. You know, and so when I had gone to the comic book shop recently, because I had not been to one for, you know, a long time.
Right.
And I saw that all this stuff was half-naked women on the covers, and yeah. they all just run into themselves, you know, the same thing. And I thought, you know, this is how shallow the book market became. They just want, you know, half-naked pinups. And then they're paying $5,000 for Walking Dead number one, when you could, for $5,000, you could buy the first Spider-Man, you could buy the first Hulk, and you could buy classic books that, those are going to be investments, and these, I feel, are just fads.
And we can buy your very first book. Tell us about that. How can we put our hands on Amphoman number one?
Well, I started a site, amphoman.com.
And can you spell that for us?
It's A, M like Mike, T-H-O-M-A-N, Amphoman, like
right.
Amphibian Man,
right.
.com. And on there, I have a link. They're print on demand, so it'll take you to Indie Planet or Comics Monkey. Those are two sites that they go to from Amphoman, but it's easier just to go directly there, and you could see all the books. I have 9 titles, 1 through 9. Now, Amphoman number one, that's there now, that's the 90s version that I made as a teen. And the new one, which I just finished, which will be out in a couple weeks, that's the new Amphoman number one remake. And so that one's going to be even more in-depth and give more story. And those are available on Amphoman.com.
And how's business?
I'm sorry?
How's business? Are they selling?
They are selling. Amphoman... the new one is not yet available, the newest one, but I already have pre-orders on that one.
Oh, brilliant.
I've sold a few dozen already, waiting once it's produced. The other ones, the new one will actually link right in and fit right into where the original number one left off. So
okay.
I didn't have to redo number 2 through 9. They actually continue. It just gives more background than number one to really give the story. And while I was in my shed, I had discovered literally hundreds of comic strips that I had drawn, and these were published works back in 94, 95, 96, that were in newspapers, because Amphoman originally started as a comic strip.
Right.
And he was a college kid, stuck in college as a frogman. It was just a funny comic strip. So I took those comic strips, and I turned those into another series called Amphoman Funnies.
Mm-hmm.
Those are also on Amphoman.com. So it's a mini-series of 3 comic books called Amphoman Funnies, and those are for all ages. It's clean humor. It's got the generation gap, which is a family from 3 generations that give their take on life. It's got Collecting Dust series, which is comics about collectibles and what they think. So if they're collectibles sitting in a shelf stuck there and getting sore on their rust spots, or different comedy behind that. And then there's the Amphoman Presents. So it's all just a collection of different humorous comics.
Okay.
So those are 3 of those.
Well,
and
I hope that listeners will take the time to go to Amphoman.com and see about your work. And I hope, Mike, you'll stay in touch with me and let us know where your appearances and your signings are going to be. And things that you've done that are new, because I very much admire the fact that, you know, you were loyal to your art and your calling and stuck with that. I think that's commendable. Well, it's the segment of the program where we talk to our friend Lawrence C. Zale. Lawrence, or Larry, as he's nice enough to let me call him, is the president of Lawrence C. Zale & Associates in New York City. It's a visual arts consulting company, and Larry has a tremendous amount of expertise that he's nice enough to share with us. Larry, welcome back.
Harold, thanks as always for having me.
Now, over the past few weeks, you've been really educating myself and other members of the audience about some of the fundamentals of what makes for meaningful collections. And, of course, last week you told us about what to look for in different types of collectibles. And this week we're going to talk about the types of objects that we should look for. Now, if I'm collecting fine art or comic books or coins or different types of things, it seems to me that there are as many kinds of objects as you can imagine. So help me wrap my hand around the general principles about the different types of things to look for.
Well, you're right, Harold. There seems to be almost an infinite variety of objects to collect. And because it is a fundamental human activity, people, as they increasingly become interested in all areas of collecting, will explore ways in which they could first collect and then add to their collections. What I find fascinating is each year there is a World Wealth Report, which is published by Capgemini and Merrill Lynch. In essence, it's a snapshot of what people collect in the various parts of the world. Here in North America, interestingly, a majority of people collect fine art collectibles, and I'll talk about the different types later on, luxury collectibles, jewelry and gems, and sports memorabilia. Fine art, for example, is anywhere from 15 to 20%. The majority, however, of what people collect can be broadly thought of as collectibles and luxury collectibles.
Now, help me understand, what is a luxury collectible?
Well, let me, if I could, go back to the collectibles, and we can discuss them, and then I'll segue, if it's all right with you, into the luxury variety.
Sure, absolutely.
We've talked about fine art, which would be paintings, drawings, prints, sculpture, and photography. Collectibles can include numismatics, comics, comics art, could be stamps, music memorabilia, timepieces, jewelry and gems, as I've mentioned earlier, and such things as movie posters, natural history, rare books, armor, and antique arts. The list goes on and on. Luxury collectibles would be the boats, the planes, the cars that are of very high value, that are bought and collected, and largely overlooked in their value and their importance in the world of collecting.
Okay, that's interesting, because the things you mentioned going in, art, comics, armor, weapons, those, and all of the, I think you said numismatic, I can't pronounce, I'm just going to say coins, okay? I'm sorry.
That's okay, I prefer coins myself.
No, yeah, that word you used for coins, those are things that, you know, lots of people consider, but the luxury items truly are luxury items: boats, planes, expensive cars. So that's interesting. And frankly, to me, unless you're Jay Leno and you own a barn full of cars, isn't something I've been really exposed to. So like I always say, we always learn something new here on the Collector's Show. So for any of those objects, whether it's a movie poster or expensive automobiles, what is it that we should, what kind of discernment should we bring to the selection process?
What strikes me about the World Wealth Report is how democratic the process of collecting really is. While they've focused in on the largest segments of collecting, no one area is more than 20% of what people collect. That leads me to believe that it's become a very democratic process where people have decided to collect so many different types of things that they need to bring the same attention to detail that they would if they were fine art collectors to whatever area of collecting they choose.
Oh, that's great, because when we connect the dots between museum quality art and things that someone like myself would look for, the same principles apply.
Very much so, and I think we should keep in mind that people should acquire objects for the same psychological reasons they would anything else, any other type of object, rather than their expectation of a return on investment.
Right.
And the way to do this, in my view, is to talk and to listen to other collectors, learn from dealers, auction house specialists, and from other qualified members of the art trade. The more information they have, the more likely the outcome will be to their liking. I would also recommend, Harold, that they not rush to purchase an object. Take the time. Even though they see something that looks too good to be true, well, give it a little more time. And if you lose out on that object, don't fret. It happens all the time. The alternative is to buy based upon a perception that if you don't, you may later regret that decision.
Yeah, I think that's a good word with respect to collectible items. If you make an impulse buy and you don't take time to use the rational part of your brain versus the emotional part, I think you're quite right that it's a lot more likely that you live to regret your spur-of-the-moment kinds of decisions. You could probably apply that to a lot of different parts of life, but for this program, we'll stick to collectibles. Sleep on it. And I know that I've experienced talking to dealers, and not a lot, but over time, where someone's tried to talk me into something because they wanted me to make a quick decision. And I always try to listen to my gut in instances like that. And if your gut says, hey, this doesn't feel quite right, or something about this doesn't strike me as 100% the right thing to do, in my experience, my gut is almost always right. And I don't know if you've had things like that, Larry.
Oh, yes. I still need to fight, and people with whom I speak who are committed collectors have to battle this urge to want to get it right away, fearing that they'll lose it. But when they become rational and think about it, that there'll be other opportunities, and they may still be able to buy this object after all, they usually will agree that was the best approach.
So, in the weeks to come, Larry's nice enough to kind of walk us through the whole process. And next week on the show, Larry, we're going to talk about appraisals and different types of appraisals. Can you give us just a quick glimpse of what that will be like?
Broadly speaking, Harold, appraisals can be just for insurance purposes, for fair market value determination, if they're going to make a donation and seek a charitable deduction, or if it's going to be part of one's estate. These are the different issues at play that collectors need to be mindful of.
So in the traditional tease of radio, you'll have to come back next week to learn more about that. And Larry, in the short time we have left, if people want to visit your website or contact you one-on-one, how can they do that?
My email address is L as in Larry, C as in Charles, Z as in Zebra, A-L-E, at AOL.com. My website is Visual Arts Advisory, that's all one word, .com.
So as always, Lawrence C. Zale, thank you so much for the education this week, and everybody come back for one quick word right after this.
Thanks, Harold.
You bet. Thank you.